All right, Erev Tov. Welcome to everyone. This is part five of a series, Great Rabbis of the 20th Century. Tonight we're discussing Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Many years ago, I visited the Tzion of the Rebbe with my father, Alva Shalom. It wasn't a special trip. My grandparents are buried on the other end of Old Montefiore Cemetery in Queens, from where the Rebbe's buried. We stopped on the way out, and as we left the grave, my father said to me, he was a real leader, without elaboration. I took it to mean that the Rebbe was a leader, not only in the sense that he had a lot of followers, but especially because he had the capacity to inspire and guide and look at the needs of the generation and do things that had never been done before, and some things that people did not even imagine were possible. So who is this man who had the capacity to guide hundreds of thousands, inspire many more, and become, in essence, a world leader, such that other, maybe real world leaders, generals, scientists, ordinary people, would seek his counsel, such that his 80th birthday was recognized by President Reagan in a special Oval Office ceremony in 1982, which, of course, the Rebbe did not attend, since he rarely left Crown Heights. He had unique gifts. He had piercing blue eyes. I met him only once as a child. Piercing blue eyes that looked right into your own, whether you're a man or a woman. He was a polyglot. He spoke many languages. He read 9 languages. He had a phenomenal memory. This story I heard from the person to whom it happened. I had a teacher who wrote a Perush on Tefillah, Sefer, and he presented it to the Rebbe at one of the Rebbe's nightly audiences, Yechidus. The Rebbe would meet people for many years until the early 80s, from about 8 p.m. at night till 3, 4 in the morning. Yechidus, he didn't sleep that much. So the Rebbe accepted the Sefer and thanked him for it. 6-7 years later, this teacher returned, mentioned the Sefer, and the Rebbe looked at him and said, yes, I had a question on page 142 or something was unclear, and they proceeded to talk about it, and the Rebbe did not know him. These were the only 2 times they ever met, when he handed him the Sefer and years later when he came back. He was a master of human interaction, yet keen insights into the human psyche. And he had exquisite sensitivity. People, you know, things that we should think of. He never used the term Beit Cholim for hospital. How do you say it in Yiddish? A crank house. Because he said it's a demoralizing Beit Cholim, house of the sick. He called it a Beit Refuah, a house of healing. He never spoke of Kirav Rechokim, bringing close those who are far. He said, who are we to say who is further from God than anyone else? And of course, he would personally dispatch shaluchim across the globe where he thought they'd be successful. It wasn't at all random. He'd keep accounts of the thousands of young men and women in Lubavitch and set them up as if he knew each one of them. So I'm not a chassid, nor am I the child of a chassid. I'm a descendant of Pruzhino, one of the 4 cities from which chassidim were banned. The Hasidic experience is foreign to me. The notion of a Rebbe who'll guide every step in your life is alien to me. And as a brisker einikel, the idea of a Rebbe dispensing blessings is a philosophical and a halachic problem, so at least I can be objective. What is it about Chabad that has taken over a good part of the Jewish world? And the answer on the surface is that they are ubiquitous. There's a Chabad presence, Chabad house institutions, in more than 100 countries on earth, and now, as of last year, in all 50 states. But the better question is, how and why? Why? How does one man talk young Jews into setting up shop in North Dakota, where, for example, they really won't have any peers, or in college campuses where they are exotic but really eccentric presences? How did he do it? And how did and why did Chabad become gripped by messianic fever, with so many of them assuming and then proclaiming that the Rebbe is the Mashiach, and even after he died, so that many Chabad jokes that just roll off my tongue, and I'll tell none of them tonight. But to me, part of the declaration or the assumption that the Rebbe was Mashiach was always outlandish, but on one level understandable. It's harmful, but also comprehensible. To answer the first part, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin of Tzadiches Amid Beis, Mashmo, what's the name of Mashiach? And the Gemara has a few answers. Debe Rabbi Shela Amre Shilo Shmo. In Rabbi Shela's yeshiva, they said his name is Shilo, like Shelo. In Rabbi Yana's yeshiva, they said Mashiach's name is Yinon. In Rabbi Chanina's yeshiva, they said Chanina Shmo, meaning each school thought its Rosh Yeshiva was the Mashiach. So, as a general rule, it's better to think one's rabbi the Mashiach than to think he's a scoundrel. Now, the Gemara goes on to say another opinion. What's the Mashiach's name? Menachem. Menachem Meshiv Nafshi, the pasuk in Eicha. So that also added, but that's not even necessarily the determinant. And yet, despite Shila and Yinon and Chanina, Menachem and everything else, we don't find this messianic fervor and or ascription of Mashiach's status to others in the Jewish world, not even in the Hasidic world, and certainly not after a person's death. Here we must discuss the great Chabad heresy that had its heyday, and I think receded, and today is only adhered to by diehards. People can argue how much the thought that the Rebbe is Mashiach, notwithstanding his death, still has substantial core of believers. I think it's a very small group. Others say it's a larger group. I think it's fringe. But the one question I've asked Chabadnikim, and to which I've never received a satisfactory answer, is this. Once you open up a Mishichut to the dead, then why the Rebbe? Why not his father-in-law, for example, whom he considered his teacher and mentor and greater than he was? Once you can choose from the dead, why not Rav Kook, or the Gra, or the Rambam, or Rabbi Akiva, or Chizkiyahu HaMelech? There's a whole world, some would say there's a whole world to come, of potentials. So I've never received a good answer to that question. Why it transcended his death, when if Mashiach come from, aside from the Christological problem, if Mashiach can come from the dead, so why not anyone else from the last 2,500 years? I think we'll get back to that, but the better question is, what type of man inspires such a belief in his followers? How does one reach the level that people believe that you're Mashiach when you're alive, and even some even when you're dead? Did he ever believe he was the Mashiach? How did this Mashiach talk begin? Has it ended? What's next for Chabad? That's all contained in the life story of one fascinating, legendary Jewish personality. And I should add, as I always do, that we're sponsored tonight by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Ben Rabbi Leib, and I thank them again. Menachem Mendel Schneerson was born on the 11th of Nisan, 1902, in the town of Nikolayev in Ukraine. The son of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, who was the Rav of the town, and his wife Chana. So he was named for his great-great-great-grandfather, the Tzemach Tzedek, who was the third Lubavitch Rebbe. So his family was already Lubavitch royalty. Note his father-in-law was Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. So Schneerson married Schneerson. He's already part of the family. He was the oldest of three sons. His brother Beryl was institutionalized with mental illness and murdered by the Nazis, and he had a younger brother, Label, who became a Trotskyite, married, made Aliyah, secularized, moved to London, and he died very young in the 1950s, early 50s. But he, his youngest brother, produced the only grandchild that Reb Levi Yitzchak Schneerson would have, a girl named Dalia, whom the Rebbe tried to be makarv over the years, mostly unsuccessfully. In 1907, his father became the Rav of Yekaterinoslav, which later changed its name to Dnipropetrovsk, meaning they had one unpronounceable name and changed to something even more unpronounceable. So that's a cosmopolitan city on the Dnieper River. It's about 240 miles southeast of Kiev. It's a big city, 70,000 Jews. And Reb Levi Yitzchak served as the Rav for more than 30 years. He endured the hardships of World War I. The town was occupied by the Germans for some time. And the Russian Revolution. There were pogroms in 1919, killed 150 Jews. 1,000 Jewish women were raped. And then the oppression and the persecution of communism. And the Jews of the city, in that city, as elsewhere in the region, were undergoing transformations as well, challenged or lured by communism, secularism, Zionism, and a few other isms as well. So the Rebbe himself grew up in a milieu in which he saw the gamut of Jewish experience and religiosity. And as you see, he and his youngest brother went in different directions. Reb Levi Yitzchak was known for his Torah and Yerushalayim, but also his worldliness, which was a threatening combination to the authorities. And he and his son, who were often threatened in the 20s by the Yevsektsiya, the Jewish section of the Communist Party, and Reb Levi Yitzchak was eventually, he was hounded for most of his life. He was deported to Kazakhstan in 1939, so it had the boon of avoiding the Nazi invasion, but he died in exile during the Holocaust, died of cancer. His wife, the Rebbe's mother, Chana, survived the Holocaust and made her way to Paris, and the Rebbe personally went to Paris in 1947 to find his mother, brought her to America, where she lived until the 1960s. In terms of biological family, the Rebbe's family was very small. So he was educated in Cheder, but from Bar Mitzvah on, he learned with his father, as well as some tutors, a wide range of subjects. So obviously he was a Talmudic genius, but he was drawn as well to the sciences. His room, while growing up, had astronomical maps on the wall. And very interesting, Reb Levi Yitzchak did not send his son, as almost every other Chabadnik did, to the Tomchei Tmimim Yeshiva in Lubavitch, where they most went. He preferred, apparently, to give him a larger general education as well. In his early 20s, Menachem Mendel became an apprentice to an engineer. Then he briefly studied at the Polytechnic University in Dnipro. In 1926, he moved to St. Petersburg to continue his studies there, and his life changed even more. St. Petersburg was Leningrad then, was the world center of Lubavitch, because Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak had fled Lubavitch. And it was the seat of the man who became his father-in-law, known as the Rebbe Rayatz, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. Now he's simply known as the Friedricher Rebbe, meaning the previous one. As a relative, he was a distant cousin, he was taken into the Rebbe's court and home, and there he met his distant cousin, Chaya Mushka Schneerson, who years later became his wife. Now the Rebbe Rayatz had succeeded his father in 1920, and he was a dominant figure. He was so great that the Rebbe himself would always consider his father-in-law superior to him in every way. And for decades, really most of his life, his only journeys outside 770 Eastern Parkway and his home a few blocks away were regular visits to his father-in-law's grave in Old Montefiore Cemetery for purposes of consolation. So the only way it makes any sense to me at all is that being at the Kever enabled the Rebbe to focus his mind better on what his father-in-law would have done in any particular situation. He's almost channeling his thoughts due to the proximity to the grave. But he was a regular visitor, and he would sit there for hours sometimes with a variety of questions, thinking through them. The Friedricher Rebbe was a tough customer. Arrested by the Soviets, he refused to reveal anything about the network of Torah institutions that Chabad was running that was now illegal under communism. So at one point, the investigator took out his revolver, put it on the table, and said, we have ways of making people like you talk. And the Rebbe said to him calmly, you can put that away. Guns only sow fear in people who believe in this world alone. But we Jews believe in an Olam Haba that's better than this world. So guns will not frighten me. and eventually was released. A number of American politicians were involved. He was temporarily exiled. At first he refused on principle to leave his flock in the Soviet Union, as many other Hasidic rebbes had done. Remember, at this point in the 1920s, he had a slew of former territories that were now independent, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, among them. And rebbes had gone there, some had gone even to Germany and to Austria. So this Rebbe, the Friedrich Rebbe, defiantly returned to Leningrad after he was jailed, but late in 1927 he uprooted the whole court, moved to Riga, Latvia, where he stayed for more than a decade. Now, Reb Menachem Mendel stayed in the Lubavitch court and learned firsthand Lubavitch customs and nuances and began dating his cousin. In something that's not entirely explicable, they did not marry for several years. They met in 1924, did not marry for 4 years. Now, there's absolutely no indication that he ever considered at this point becoming Rebbe at any point in the future. Indeed, the Rayatz, the Friedrich Rebbe, had three daughters. He already had a son-in-law who was construed as his natural successor, Shmaryahu Gurari, who was his top assistant, and married his oldest daughter, Chana, in 1920, just a few months after he had become the Rebbe. It's a very complicated dynamic in how Rabbi Nachum Mendel became the Rebbe and not his older brother-in-law left hard feelings that split the family. While all this was going on, and before he married, Rabbi Menachem Mendel made plans to leave Russia once and for all. He traveled in 1927 to see his parents in Dnipro, and he parted company with them. He never got to see his father again. After a few years, he could not again enter Russia. His father was not allowed to leave Russia. He went to Latvia, and then he decided to study in Berlin, the world center of thought at the time. He studied at Friedrich Wilhelm University. Today it's Humboldt University of Berlin, main campus. I remember walking by. It's on Unter den Linden in the heart of Berlin. And there he encountered, I mean, it's amazing to think about it, the people attracted to Friedrich Wilhelm University then, giants of Jewish life. While he was in the university, Rav Salvechik was there, Rav Yitzhak Kutner was there, Nechama Leibowitz was there, and others as well. It was a world center of thought. Interestingly, he never received a degree. He was never matriculated at Friedrich Wilhelm University, not in Berlin, not in other universities he studied in the 20s and into the 30s. It's also not entirely clear from whom he received smicha. He would pop in on occasion at the Hildesheimer Seminary, where the Sridei Eish, Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, was the Rosh Yeshiva, but he was not matriculated there. I think I'll hear shiurim from time to time. So some reports have him receiving smicha from the Sridei Eish, where others report that he received smicha from the Rogachev, Rabbi Yosef Rosen, the Rogachev Agoin in Dvinsk. For several years, he'd return to Riga for the Yom Tovim, but he didn't really have any formal position in Lubavitch. In Berlin, he apparently wore modern clothing. He had a trim beard, unlike Lubavitch custom. And it's so interesting that the Friedrich Rebbe was opposed to college education, as the Rebbe, for the most part, was later in life as well. And yet it was his future father-in-law who funded his college education, both before and after he married. Rabbi Nachum Mendel finally pulled the plug, married Chaya Mushka in Warsaw, November 27th, 1928. He was 26, she was 27. They'd seen each other almost 4 years. One cause for the delay, so all this is, a lot of this is wrapped in mystery of Chabad. He wanted his parents to attend, and he kept hoping that his father would receive permit to leave the country, but he eventually married without his parents present. Another reason was that Lubavitch had fallen into hard financial times. And we'll see, there's always this aspiration to be a monarchy, a royalty, a palace, etc. And the Rebbe wanted to have some funds to have a some sort of fancy wedding. Chaya Mushka was also a little more open than her parents, more worldly, more modern. Years earlier, she'd ruled out an arranged marriage, such as her older sister had had. She was cultured, she attended the theater. Some say she did when they lived in New York also. She didn't present as a Hasidic wife, and certainly not as a potential Rebbe's wife. So she had a younger sister, in addition to her older one, she had a younger sister, Shana, who also married someone named Mendel, and sadly they were murdered in the Holocaust, most likely in Treblinka. Why Warsaw? Because apparently the Rebbe Rayatz wanted to elevate Lubavitch's profile with a big wedding that attracted other Rebbes and many Jews. It didn't. Several invitees, including the Ger Rebbe who lived in Warsaw, just declined to attend. The Chassan did not wear a strimel, but he wore a black fedora with a snap brim, later to become famous as the Lubavitch hat. After marriage, the couple returned to Berlin. She, too, attended university to learn German. Again, there's no indication that the Rebbe was interested in a Lubavitch career in the slightest. When the Rebbe visited the U.S. in 1929, he asked Menachem Mendel to accompany him and Rav Gurari, and he politely declined, preferring to stay in Berlin. Later that year, his father-in-law wanted him to accompany him to Israel, to the land of Israel, and again he declined. They moved to Paris in 1933 after Hitler came to power, and he took a full schedule of courses in the university there, but he ran afoul of the school authorities with 60 unexplained absences in 1 year, almost all related to his refusal to attend class on Shabbos. But after years, 1938, age 36, he finally received a degree in engineering. He studied briefly in the Sorbonne after that. There's a copy, one of the books I read, of a picture of a letter he sent to his parents. It had the return address, ENG period M. Schneerson, meaning Engineer M. Schneerson, which is how he saw himself. They tried to obtain residence permits in France, but at this point he had no home and no citizenship, having been stripped of his Russian passport a few years earlier. By all accounts, the couple had a happy marriage, first in Berlin, then in Paris, and then in Crown Heights. The Rebbe, just to jump ahead for a moment, kept a superhuman schedule, but he never deviated from having morning coffee with his wife every single morning. Just the two of them, maybe 15 minutes, 30 minutes, just the two of them to talk. So here in Paris, they enjoyed life as newlyweds, and Rabbi Menachem Mendel's involvement in Chabad seemed to be limited to researching manuscripts in Berlin libraries for his father-in-law. There are critics who paint him as someone less than fully observant during this time, but it seems the opposite. To combat the lures of Western Europe, he engaged in sigufim, fasting daily. He would fast until after Mincha, till his father wrote him, told him to stop, to keep up his moral level, to keep distant from the secular culture as much as possible. For sure, one thing plagued the couple: childlessness. They never had children, and that would haunt them and aggrieve the Rebbe his whole life, and play a huge role in the messianic mysteries that unfolded. March 1940, the Rebbe Rayatz escaped Poland by the skin of his teeth. Keep in mind, the Nazis invaded September 1st, 1939. Rebbe was in hiding most of that time. See, he was able to travel in secret from Warsaw to Berlin, strange, to Kovno, to Riga, to Sweden, and then sailed to New York, where he arrived on March 18th, 1940. He was already ill. The Friedrich Rebbe was suffering from MS, as well as the after effects of a stroke in 1937. His Talmidim offered to find him a nice place to convalesce and live out the rest of his life, and he right away got to work. We'll see in a moment. But the Rebbe and his wife were stuck. The Rebbe and Chaya Mushka, the Rayatz and his family held Latvian citizenship so they could leave. The Rebbe was stateless, but special efforts were made, especially by Rav Gurari, to extract them from France. Ironically, the Rebbe's visa was approved personally by the State Department's Breckinridge Long, who became one of the real villains of America's lackluster effort to save Jews during the Holocaust. The Schneersons arrived in America on June 23, 1941, just right after the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union. Soon after, he took a job in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, some not engineering, but mathematics capacity, and he became slowly more involved in Chabad affairs. By this time, his father-in-law had settled in 770 Eastern Parkway that his Hasidim bought for him in 1940. In November 1946, the Rebbe became an American citizen and shortly thereafter was given an official job in the Chabad system, running some of their constituent organizations. Meanwhile, the Friedrich Rebbe was busy at work, continuing the Chabad pattern. Just weeks after arriving in 1940, he issued a kol kore, a proclamation, calling on American Jews to repent. Yeah, it didn't go over well. Calling them to repent, observe Shabbos, mikvah, tefillin, kashrus, give their children a religious education. It didn't make much of an impact. But he persevered, and he blamed the horrors in Europe on the lack of commitment of American Jews. And he said they would be next unless they did tshuva. The truth is, those types of proclamations have never worked for American Jews. So the Rebbe, the previous Rebbe was largely ignored when he wasn't outright being attacked. But one point that the Rebbe Rayatz made again and again lingered among his followers, that the Tsarists in Europe could only be a precursor to Bias HaMashiach, to Mashiach's coming, and that Mashiach was therefore coming very soon. It wasn't long before his Hasidim began to assume that the Friedrich Rebbe's talk of the imminence of Mashiach implied that he was the Mashiach. And that factor weighed heavily on Chabad and others, and of course became a major theme of the Rebbe's tenure. So he didn't make it up. He was just continuing his father-in-law's derech that were on the verge of Yemos HaMashiach. When he, the Rebbe, would speak to people, though, about world events, it would be much less fire and brimstone than his father-in-law, and more the blessings and glories and opportunities to serve God in the Messianic era. The Friedrich Rebbe's health deteriorated over the next few years. He spent most of his time in a wheelchair until he died Shabbos morning, January 28th, 1950, the 10th of Shvat. He left no will and no male successors. So he had two sons-in-law. Remember, the other one had been killed in the Holocaust. And the natural successor, it seemed to many, was Rav Gurari, who'd been in his side now for 30 years. And yet it didn't happen. There was jockeying for almost a year. Each person had his own camp, his own supporters. At certain times, each person was declared by his followers to be the Rebbe. Rav Gurari had many supporters and something else as well. He had the only heir, a son named Barry, a Shalom Dover, named after the grandfather. Barry's not such a Rebbe name, but nonetheless. Many said, why appoint a childless Rebbe? I mean, remember, this time the Rebbe is 48 years old, his wife is 49. So again, there's a lot of speculation, revisionism around these points, but it seems that the Rebbe's widow, Nechama Dina, supported her older son-in-law, Rav Gurari, who had actually lived in 770 with them for many years, to be the Rebbe's successor. So much so that when the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel, accepted the crown, so to speak, in 1951, she refused to give him the Friedrich Rebbe's shtreimel, which was the official Chabad hat. So the Rebbe didn't complain. He simply adopted his black fedora with the brim snapped down, as you see here, as the Chabad hat until today. That's the reason why the Lubavitcher is the only Hasidic group without a first shtreimel. Everybody, but everybody wears this hat, and wherever you go in the world, ever, any place in the world, and you see this hat, you know underneath it is a Chabadnik. Relations between the two sisters were forever strained. And again, there's a lot of talk, it's not so, but it seems to be so. When their mother died in the 60s, they sat Shiva separately. Chana Gurari never accepted her brother-in-law's the Rebbe, notwithstanding that the Rebbe, to his credit, gave Rav Shmaryo, his brother-in-law, a very prominent position, the Chabad hierarchy in the Chinuch division. He headed one of the organizations. But it gets worse. He if he had any bitterness, he overcame it. His wife never did, which happens as well. It gets worse. In the 1980s, Barry Gurari was seen on tape removing valuable books and manuscripts from the Chabad library under his coat and selling them. By then he was near retirement age. He lacked cash. He sold some of the books and manuscripts for a few $100,000, and then he was outed. Now he took it, he claimed, based on what his mother said to him, that he's the only heir. The Friedrich Rebbe, in possession of all Chabad assets, had two heiresses, his mother and his aunt, all right? He's entitled to 50% what his mother shared. His mother said he could take it. Well, in a long and bitter case that was tried in the federal court in New York, the Chabad organization won. The Rebbe succeeded in recovering almost all the books because he claimed it's not a Yerusha at all. It's not his property. Like, it wasn't his father's property, but rather it belongs to Chabad as an organization. It belongs to the Hasidim. The day the decision came out, Charles Sifton was the judge, became a Chabad holiday as well. The Don Notzach, our side won. What makes it more painful is that Reb Shmaryahu supported the Rebbe. Chana supported her son, and then the latter two were estranged from Reb Shmaryahu Gerari the rest of their lives, so much so that they separated. She and her son are buried here in New Jersey, while he's buried near the Rebbe in Queens. After much pressure, fits and starts, hesitation, deliberation, infighting, the Rebbe declared his nesius on the 10th of Shvat, 1951, exactly on the first yard site, and he did it in a very dramatic way. So previous year, the Rebbe Rayatz had issued a pamphlet on Friday entitled Bosi Ligani, I've come to the garden, about Ikar Shechina Batachtonim Haisa, that God's dwelling place is really amongst us here on earth, unless it's driven away by sin, such as that of Adam. But it was, and it was brought back by the seven tzaddikim until Moshe. And then this week's Sedra, Vasudhi Mikdash V'Shachanti B'Socham, we build a Mikdash, we bring God's presence back. And he compared the Avodah and the Mikdash, the Avodah of every Jew, the simple Jew to conquer the Yetzer Hara, and the tzaddik to engage in the process of hafocha, not to suppress evil, but to transform evil and elevate it to kedusha. It was released on Friday, and the Rebbe died the very next morning before discussing it. Exactly 1 year later, Rav Menachem Mendel assumed power, and he literally picked up where the Rebbe left off. He cited in order ma'amarim from each of his six predecessors, and he immediately set the tone of his nesius, two primary goals that will be interconnected, but of course would follow the previous Rebbe's lead. If you look at number one in the handout, this was his Maimer Chasidus, the day he took power, which is a continuation of the Basi Ligani, Tovshin Yudalf, 1951. V'neza tovim mikol achad v'chad meitanu, what's demanded of each of us, Dor HaShvi'i, the seventh generation, to call Ashvin Chavivin. Every seventh is holy. So note, parenthetically, that he's referencing here Chabad tradition, there will be only seven Rebbes, and then the Mashiach comes. So the seventh is the most precious. Dim Hayosh Zat Shanach Badar Shvi, Hula Pi Bechiraseinu, Pi Avodaseinu. The fact that we're the seventh is not by our choice, not through anything that we've done. Maybe it's not even according to our will. Nonetheless, all the sevenths are precious. Now we're in the footsteps of Mashiach. We're at the end of the era of the footsteps of Mashiach. Vavodah, therefore our job now is ligmor am shachas ha-shechina, to complete the drawing in of the shechina, lo rak shechina ki ikar shechina uvatachtonim dafka. We have to draw God's presence to earth even more by making the awareness of God, the consciousness of God, central to all of mankind, especially to Jews. Well, the ambition, therefore, that the Rebbe set out was classic Chabad, but articulated in a very executed in a very modern way, to bring the light of Torah to every place of darkness on earth, in line with Yafutzu Mayinosecha Chutza, that the spring should spread forth outside. And very soon began the era of Shluchim, unique to Chabad. Almost every other Hasidic sect is insular, cut off from the outside world. They are the exact opposite. So it started modestly at first, a few people on campuses, Zalman Schachter, Shlomo Karlbach, each with checkered records later, and each not some disassociated, the Schachter disassociated, but Shlomo Karlbach never did, but he was not a Chabadnik, and later a full-fledged program of dispatching Lubavitchers wherever there were Jews. And this made Chabad the most ubiquitous group of Jews in the world, a boon, as we know, to religious travelers, and a bomb to simple, even unaffiliated Jews who wanted a taste of Torah, an idea, a meal, a friendly Jewish face, a warm, non-judgmental reception. And this is a classic theme in the Rebbe's Torah. If you look for a moment in number 2, see here the Rebbe is commenting, it's on last week's Sedra, on the Pasuk V'rapoi Rapei, that a doctor is given reshus, permission to heal. So he says, doctors have permission to heal in some cases, but in other cases they have an obligation to heal. When? A different pasuk, Vashevo Salom, in terms of Ashava Saveda, a doctor, just like we have to return a lost object, a doctor has to return the lost health of an individual. So he says, it's the second paragraph, just as there are life-threatening and non-life-threatening bodily illnesses, so it is with spiritual illnesses. Spiritually, a person is in mortal danger when his condition has begun to affect his ability or desire to fulfill the Torah and its commandments. Since through our mitzvos, our spiritual vitality flows into us. So the rules pertaining to a physical doctor also apply to a spiritual doctor. That is, anyone who is capable of helping someone who is spiritually ill. When someone is suffering from a minor spiritual ailment, we're encouraged, reshus, to offer spiritual assistance. But when someone is in mortal danger, meaning his fulfillment of the mitzvahs is threatened, we are obligated to offer assistance, not allowing any other considerations to get in the way. In fact, that was his derech, that was the basic theme of his nesius. Now, obviously, the emphasis on Mashiachut was a two-edged sword. Note that he said, we're in Ikvasa de Mashiacha, we're besiyuma de Ikvasa at the very end, and yet Chabad was always anti-Zionist. And the Rebbe himself was never a Zionist. He became a non-Zionist over time with an appreciation of the state of Israel, but he was never a Zionist. He was critical of Rav Kook and the whole religious Zionist movement. But he did see, became an active proponent of the value of the state of Israel in propagating Torah and Jewish values. Nonetheless, so much emphasis was placed on Mashiachut that his supporters were primed for a fall. Note that when the Rebbe Rayatz died, a lot of the Hasidim thought he was the Mashiach as well, and there was Great Depression. It would be worse with the Rebbe because he left no survivors at all. As noted, his approach in his mind was just a natural progression from his predecessors, but he took Chabad in directions that were unprecedented in American life. The theme was Uforatzta, first with campus outreach, the first of the Chabad houses, followed years later by the creation of Chabad houses across the globe, wherever Jews live or frequently visited. Now, it's not an easy life. These are the most cheerful people you'll ever meet, and don't wonder why. They're just different personalities. And going back to the Rebbe's time, he handpicked them. Most have been successful. Some went native. Some even left or were forced to leave Chabad, but they're part of the community in which they live, but they're also outsiders. In most cases, looking completely different, distinctly Jewish than the population they serve. So for years, the Rebbe chose a couple, a shaluach and a shlucha, serving together and dispatched them to a spot on the globe. Once a father, high in the hierarchy, complained to the Rebbe when he sent his son and daughter-in-law to, I think it was Brazil. And the Rebbe said, officers do not challenge the general. The general sends his soldiers where the general thinks the soldiers can fulfill the mission. He said in a nicer way, but that was the basic point. Now, the Chabadnikim are given a stipend for a year, maybe two, and then expected to become self-sufficient.
building a mikveh, building a nursery. Nursery is always called Gan Yisrael everywhere in the world, the Garden of Israel, because the Rebbe said every Jewish child is a sapling, a place to daven, a place to learn, and most frequently a place to eat as well. As a matter of routine, and the Chabad Pesach, they only eat Chol Yisrael, and it's a great personal sacrifice. They'll go for weeks without milk or cheese or butter, and then stock up until they run out. In many places, they have no natural peers. In others, they meet opposition from the local Jewish official community, with whom they don't often interact well, and with whom they compete for charity dollars. In many places, it creates a real mess. In other places, especially since the Rebbe's death, there's been litigation with one Beit Chabad encroaching on the territory of another. And it's become even more common in recent years, and probably a positive development, for the Chabad rabbi to become the official Rav of the town, the Ashkenazi Rav of the town or city. So it's not officially Chabad, but from their perspective, it serves the same purpose as Kiruv, Talmud Torah, and the provision of Jewish services without the hassle of self-support. Now these shluchim, in a real sense, were his children, but in a real sense, he kept albums in his desk drawers with their pictures and their children's pictures and names. When his wife died in 1988, as soon as the news came, he said to his top aide, first notify the shluchim, because she, Chaya Mushko, was their mother and grandmother. People flock to these Chabad houses, and not just travelers, but locals, people distant from Judaism. Some affiliated non-Orthodox, they find Chabad open and non-judgmental, and the business of providing positive Jewish experiences. And the Rebbe was very open. I saw in a few places, there's a Reform rabbi who wants to become a shtickle frum, and the Rebbe said, no, you have to stay in your temple. That's where you have to serve and make the people there better Jews. You're a soldier too. It's a great model, but don't ask why everyone isn't like that. I mean, the fact is, Chabad doesn't distinguish between people observe Shabbos or don't observe Shabbos, people intermarried, not intermarried, people educated, not educated. They don't get involved in Geirus. That's all fine, but you couldn't sustain a Jewish community along those lines. If everyone's accepting of intermarriage, you just incentivize intermarriage. So while they cannot be the community, from my perch, it is good that they exist for the community. And you know, there are idiosyncrasies also. I've always been puzzled by the inclination of Chabadnikim to teach Tanya first. I've been in some of these wayward places where there's a shir in Tanya, not Aleph Beis, not Chumash, not Halacha. They teach Tanya. Teach something more mainstream. No. See this over here? I was once visiting an unnamed illegal outpost south of Hebron. They had done a few caravans starting to build something. And in one of the caravans, there was a printing press in the back. And I walked into the back. I said, what are you doing? And the guy said, we are publishing copies of the Tanya. All right? So you see, Drom Har Hebron, that's the place. Southern Har Hebron. Just printing copies of the Tanya. All right. It's quite an abstruse, esoteric work. It's not really accessible to the average person, but nonetheless, some people are only reached through the mystical and paradoxically through something they don't understand fully. That is to say, the more esoteric it is, the more alluring it is. And what he wanted to give everyone was a sense of God's presence. That's how he understands. You can read this on your own. Number three, it's on this week's Sedra. Vasuli Mikdash V'Shachanti B'Sacham. Make a sanctuary for me. So the idea of making a sanctuary for God is puzzling. God is God. He's not physical. So how does God, V'Shachanti B'Sacham, how does he dwell among us? Secondly, why is the dwelling needed in the first place? Isn't God everywhere? And explains, it goes into four as well, that the experience of God is very often subjective. People will say they feel God in nature, in science, in music, in mitzvahs and Torah too. But God's presence becomes so dilute, it can be clouded by our own subjective yearnings and predispositions. But in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, it's different. There you saw, because the miracles that took place regularly, you saw God's hand, you felt God's presence. That's why the experience of God in the Mishkan, in the Mikdash, was completely different than any other type of spiritual experience, so to speak, that one would have. Now, in the early years of the Rebbe's tenure, he established programs that have become familiar to us. The mitzvah tanks, whose commanders stopped men on the street, asked them if they were Jewish, and they put on tefillin that day. I've been asked a number of times, who's been asked here if you put on tefillin today? I always have the same answer. How many times a day must I put on tefillin? All right. For some people, it's the first time they put it on since their bar mitzvah. Others continue to do it. If you want to, they'll get a pair of tefillin for you. And the Rebbe maintained, this is crucial to the understanding of Jewish life, every single mitzvah is important. Every single mitzvah performed by every individual Jew. There was the Ner Shabbos campaign, they called it Neshek. Weapons, Ner Shabbos Kodesh, Ner Shabbos Kodesh. Neshek, that every Jewish woman, and even little girls, is not the common custom. Girls over the age of 3 should light Shabbos candles with Chabad advertising every Friday in the front page of the Times, the candle lighting of that day, and urging all women and girls to light. It was a drive to encourage all Jews to get a Torah education, which such was not popular. Even less popular among secular Jews was the Rebbe's campaign in the early 1960s to allow prayer in public school, at the very least, moments of silence in the public schools, especially after the Supreme Court decision in Engel versus Vitali. This really troubled him when the court ruled defined prayer is unconstitutional. So the Rebbe said it's not a good scene for the schools. I think it was 1962. This was the offensive prayer that the court ruled unconstitutional. Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon Thee, and we beg Thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. Amen. Wow, shocking. So he wasn't successful, but he was prescient in realizing that taking God out of the public school took values out of the public school, and it wasn't very long that the schools were dealing with assaults and homicides and drugs and pregnant seventh graders as well. During the Six-Day War and thereafter, the mitzvah tanks were taken to a new level as the Rebbe dispatched them to the Suez Canal, to the Golan, to help soldiers put on tefillin. He became a leading fighter, uncompromising, in the Who is a Jew law in Israel. It should reflect halacha, and that non-Jews should embrace the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. He was adamantly opposed to surrendering land for peace, and told this directly to prime ministers like Begin, who came to visit him. There was the Tzedakah campaign. That's when he started meeting people and handing out dollar bills for Tzedakah, and always Avas Yisrael, love of all Jews, whatever their spiritual state. It's interesting his approach to non-Jews. If you turn to the back, look at the Jews and non-Jews. I will look at both quickly, number 5. So this is from a book I bought in Israel a few years ago, Tshuvot L'Shalot HaChayim. It's a compilation of the Rebbe's letters that he sent out over the course of 35 years, almost 40 years. He would spend the day in 770 and go back to his house a few blocks away, and he would take a satchel of letters. Most he would respond by hand, others he would dictate. So this, number 5, was a question someone asked him: how can he convince his friends not to work on Shabbos, because they think it ruins their parnasa? So the Rebbe answers that it seems these people believe in God, because if not, they wouldn't ask the question, but then they're acting illogically, because God will never ask a human being to do something that's beyond his capability. We as humans wouldn't ask someone, impose a task on someone they could not do. Allah has kama v'kama, God would not do such a thing. So therefore, everyone knows that the situations in which Shabbos is not a problem at all, like going to a business closed on Shabbos, but what God is doing here is not just asking you to withstand the trial, but tell them, lo zubuvad, elagam mivazvez kachot kachot nefesh. What they're doing is squandering the spiritual powers that they have. If they have the capacity, and everyone does, adhere to the Ratzon Hashem, and they don't, it means they're not fully engaging their spiritual potential. And number six, another question a woman wrote, why are Jews so suspicious of the world? So he says, well, 1975, he mentions the Holocaust, but he says, look even at the UN today. But nonetheless, he says, despite the fact that the world, the UN, is against the Jews, with exceptions, nonetheless, it's the second paragraph from the bottom. L'shem Hashva, kedai l'tzayin shal yudim mitzidam mutel chova l'orer kol goy l'sayel lo nog ha'pi tzivim al-kiyim asher nitnu l'cho min anashi. Nonetheless, we are still obligated from our side to arouse in every non-Jew to guide him along the lines of these divine commands, klomar the Shem Mitzvah B'nai Noach. And that was another campaign that he had, to teach non-Jews of the Noahide laws, like the Rambam writes, Shem HaRamah Minimali Shel Etika Musariyot. It's the lowest level of ethics and Musar, the natural societal order that people should follow. Without that, we are just in a jungle. Now, the Rebbe also had a special interest in Soviet Jews, as Chabad was founded in Russia. He had emissaries in Russia who suffered inordinately for decades. People who taught Torah in secret, baked matzahs in secret, tried to encourage mitzvahs in Jewish life. The Rebbe opposed public demonstrations. He preferred quiet diplomacy. But then he was very active, intensely active behind the scenes, spearheading, learning, visits, using political connections. He was tuned in to intelligence officers in a variety of countries who would report to him on what's happening to Jews in the Soviet Union. And he once said, very interestingly, that there aren't 3 million Soviet Jews. There are 30 million. By that he meant that intermarriage and assimilation had taken a toll, but there's so many Jewish souls, children of Jewish fathers and Jewish grandfathers, who could also be redeemed. And Hermann Brandhove, the great physicist, says the Rebbe told him in 1985, the USSR is on the verge of collapse. It'll just be a few years. He brought a sense of joy to Jewish life. God had to be served with simcha. I say without passing judgment that Chabadnikim have been known to take a drink or two before davening and after davening and sometimes during davening. A couple years ago I was in Mitzpeh Ramon with the missus, and I dropped into a shul. I realized it was Chabad shul daven Ma'ariv. As soon as I walk in, the rabbi there offers me a shot of vodka. And he says, the minig of the place is we don't daven unless we drink first. And I hurt his feelings by declining. They drank, and after the final baruch hu, put another bottle for more drinking. Chabad Fabrengens were legendary. Almost every Shabbos, he spoke for hours on Torah topics, duly memorized by four geniuses who transcribed them after Shabbos, and these became the volumes, dozens of volumes of the Sichot of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And of course, he became known as a counselor and advisor. Jews and non-Jews of all stripes would seek an audience, yechidus, with him. He would answer dozens of letters every day. I mentioned the audience would start early evening, last till 3, 4 in the morning. Apparently, he didn't sleep those nights. And some people saw briefly, others were given more time. At a certain point, you had to make an appointment months in advance in order to see him. Part of it was the mystique. You're entering in the dead of night, everything is quiet, and it's a dark room, and he's talking to you. But who sought his advice? Politicians, generals, businessmen, scientists, doctors. He was obviously brilliant, well-educated. Of course, not all his medical advice was on target. I've heard stories of bad advice given also. Lapsed Chabadnikim, of which there are some of the most bitter people you'll ever meet. But nonetheless, people kept coming, and if they keep coming, it's because the advice is generally good advice. He was asked by a young woman whether he thought he knew more medicine than doctors and more law than the lawyers. And the Rebbe answered that when a house is built, the architect draws up a blueprint, and he gives it to the contractor, and the contractor hires carpenters, plumbers, electricians, etc., and tells them what to do. And it's not that the contractor can do it better, but that he's read the blueprint. And so he knows what has to take place. He said, the Torah is the blueprint for the world as God created it. So if you understand the Torah, you can give people advice, even if he doesn't know more law or medicine or business than they do. He knew how to talk to people. He never shied away from a question. He knew how to answer those questions. One story that I love, I told in shul a few years ago, is from Heshy Weinrib, member, head of the OU for a few years. So at a certain point in his career, his early 70s, he was mesupik. He didn't know whether to pursue the rabbinate or psychology full-time. So he called up the Rebbe for advice, spoke to the secretary, and he presented the question without giving his name. He said he's from Maryland. Rebbe overheard and said to his secretary over the phone, "Tell him there's a Jew in Maryland he should speak to. Der Yid heißt Weinreb. His name is Weinreb." So the secretary repeated it, and Heshy Weinreb said, "But my name is Weinreb." So the Rebbe answered, "Azoy, sometimes a person needs to speak to himself." And he said, "That's the best advice he ever got." He sat and thought, and he decided exactly what he wanted to do with his career. He didn't always tell people what to do, nor did people always listen when he told them what to do. But through conversation, he could elicit what they thought was best for themselves, and that is how he guided them. So an interesting story. In 1968, Shirley Chisholm was elected the first black female congressperson. And she was very bitter because there was still racism, and they put her on the agricultural committee. Last I noticed, few farms in Bed-Stuy, all right? And she thought it was just a racist attack by the Southern Democrat chairman of the committee to marginalize her. She'd accomplished nothing. She accomplished nothing for her constituents. The Rebbe asked to see her, and she came to the Rebbe. He never went to see anybody. And he said to her, "You're bitter because you think that they're marginalizing, they're insulting you. But you could use your position to help the poor, because now I got your food." She met with Bob Dole, just elected senator, and the two of them expanded the food stamp program in Kansas and other states that had all the surplus corn and grain they were going to destroy, and now they just rerouted it. So poor got it. She became one of the founders of the WIC program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance, and she credited the Rebbe for that. And he said, "Because of him, you have poor children in America eating, where otherwise they would not eat." He had this charisma, had those blue eyes. People were drawn to become his followers. But there's always a downside to a cult of personality, and it didn't require the Mashiach business to emerge. So for example, Shemini Atzeres night, 1977, he had chest pains, and he refused to see a doctor. And then when he fainted and turned green, and was revived and turned green again, he still refused to be hospitalized. He had a heart attack, serious heart attack. A mini hospital was constructed at 770, but every doctor recommended hospitalization and then was dismissed. They had to fly a doctor from Chicago who would treat him, because they told him to put him in a hospital would exacerbate his condition, but of course it's extremely dangerous. The thing is, if you build up the aura of a superhuman, then you go to a hospital and you're just a patient in a gown being treated by nurses. And that's no place for royalty, and certainly not when your disciples have messianic pretensions for you. So this would have even more dramatic consequences in 1992, when on a visit to his father-in-law's grave, he asked for his bodidus to spend time alone, and when they checked on him 4 hours later, they found him on the floor, unable to speak. At some point, he'd had a stroke, so he was rushed back to 770. By many medical indications, how they found him earlier, even taking him to a hospital when they discovered, the effects of the stroke would have been lessened. He wasn't. And so the last year and a half of his life fueled the messianic speculations in ways that are strange and troubling, often bizarre. He couldn't speak anymore. He could barely lift an arm, barely move his head. No one really knew what he comprehended and didn't comprehend. It's what happens to an extremist mindset. Everything that should logically refute the thesis is instead proof of the thesis. And of course, this is part of the mystique of Hasidism, one that looks contrived to an outsider, the trappings of royalty. So Hasid cannot shake the Rebbe's hand, lese majeste. The Rebbe never left Crown Heights except to go to the Kever. When Shneur Zalman Shazar, Chabad family, President of Israel, came, He had to go to 770. Rebbe's going to see him. Begin, other prime ministers, politicians went to him. He never went to anybody as if he was a head of state, which to his followers he was. In truth, much of this was a replay of what happened when his father-in-law took ill and died. So he too was subject to the Mashiach talk. And one reason why the Rebbe refused to assume the mantle of leadership is because he maintained the Friedrich was still the Rebbe. What's the difference whether he's in this world or the next world? He's still the Rebbe. But after the 1977 heart attack, the Rebbe increased the Mashiachut. And that's when the We Want Mashiach Now campaign began. And he spoke regularly of Mashiach's imminent arrival. So much so that many, most, maybe all, Chabadnikim assumed he was the Mashiach and pleaded with him to reveal himself. And I'll note, for accuracy's sake, this actually started in the 1950s. It was one reason why Chabad was controversial in the Orthodox world. And even in Brooklyn, there was routine antagonism between Chabad and other groups like Satmar, even fisticuffs. One Brooklyn Rosh Yeshiva said of him in the 1950s, he's either a Navi or a faker, and I know he's not a Navi. So he was controversial even in our world. So he too assumed his father-in-law was the Mashiach, but he never revealed himself as such, obviously. And he did try on occasion to squelch such talk. He explicitly denied it several times, even left a will, disposing of his assets, all to Chabad. I think he left an estate of about $50,000, very little. At the same time, he in later years would speak of bringing Mashiach Mamish, all right? Actually, literally. But of course, until you realize that the Mamish are his initials, Menachem Mendel Schneerson. So there was always a coyness about this issue. A lot of tap dancing, winks and nods, polite demurs. Clearly, to flirt with Mashiachut is to play with fire, and many were burnt. So I personally think by now, Mashiachut and Chabad has receded, is now minority opinion, but it's still prevalent, but it can be quite jarring. In the Beis Medrash, the basement in 770, I was there a few years ago for something. I think it was a wedding outside, I don't remember. You walk in the Beis Medrash, the big poster, all right? A half the size of that, declaring the Rebbe Mashiach. It's a psak, signed by more than 100 Chabad rabbis, Dayanim, and others. We paskin, in the usual language, we paskin that. I'm the Mets' new first baseman. It's not going to matter. But that's their psak. The first time I heard the Yechid chant was in Venice. It took me by surprise. It was a Hagbah. They lifted the Torah. Yechid Adonenu, Melchi Olam Vod. I laughed. Then I realized that they were serious. You drive to Tel Aviv now. There's a big billboard on the Netiv Ayalon proclaiming the Rebbe's Mashiach, looking down. It's an ongoing problem, diminishing in intensity. It's been more than 24 years, of course. But both because of the obvious Christological references, a Mashiach rising from the dead is never a mainstream Jewish concept, and because it detracts from the reality of the glorious era in which we're living today, one which is ripe with Mashiach potential. Mashiach can't come if some Jews think he has already come, and that is a problem. It's a problem that's unique to Chabad because of its messianic emphases, because the Rebbe left no successor, because the seventh Rebbe was to be the last. He was asked who will succeed him. And he said Mashiach will come and resolve that problem. But it's also endemic to a Hasidic mindset that places so much importance on the personality of the Rebbe as an intermediary, as possessing a special connection to God, as endowing him with supernatural traits, all of which are anathema to misnagdim and defy some traditional fundamental Torah principles and is difficult to sustain. Rav Kook warned in Orot HaKodesh against deifying any human being, even a tzaddik, really identifying too closely with any human being, because then you'll be led to embrace even their bad traits, not just their good ones. Another excess, as I see it, is a construction of 13 red brick replicas of 770 Eastern Parkway across the world, from Israel to Australia. I was at the dedication of the first in Kfar Chabad. Were you there? Kfar Chabad, they held a mass bar mitzvah of children, orphan children of IDF soldiers. So I attended. I mean, they flew in red bricks from America to make a perfect duplicate. How perfect? They researched in the archives in Brooklyn the plumbing, the interior plumbing plans of the building that was built in 1919 should be exact on the inside as well. None of this resonates with the Misnagid. And of course, never once in his life did the Rebbe visit Israel. Just to conclude, the Rebbe died early Sunday morning, Gimel Tammuz, 1993, was buried in Old Montefiore a few hours later, right next to his father-in-law. The graves are now covered with thousands of notes awaiting a response. Part of the cemetery was taken over by Chabad. There's now a 24/7 presence, including a fax machine, maybe now email, to receive notes from across the world, throw them on the grave. It's become a shrine. It's also a mixed blessing, because people attribute to it supernatural powers, which is, again, not the Torah as we know it, but people go there. Who knows? The night before Election Day 2016, Ivanka Trump went to the Rebbe's grave and davened. Maybe her wishes came true? I don't know. And yet, Chabad marches along, stronger than ever, more influential than ever, carrying the Rebbe's mandate to love every Jew, spread Torah and the Dvar Hashem, do mitzvos, even one, but the more the better. In 1994, posthumously, Rebbe became the only rabbi ever to be awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. See, take away the mysticism and the paranormal and the mishichut, which detracts from his legacy, and we're left with an astonishing, extraordinary human being who guided and taught and led and inspired multitudes, and his life and writings continues to inspire them. See, if his goal was to bring Mashiach, in that he did not succeed, but he did, in a paradoxical way, bring the idea and imminence of Mashiach to audiences far and wide and give untold number of Jews a foothold in the world of Torah. Yehi Zichro Baruch. I will next meet March 12th, and we'll look at the life and Torah of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Thank you all for coming.